Call for Action presents Of Consuming Interest, a public service show that discusses scams, deceptive offers, and other consumer concerns. Here's the director of WUSA 9 Call for Action and your host, Shirley Rooker.
Climate change discussions can enliven dinner parties because there are so many opinions on this issue. Well, climate change initiatives have had and will have a significant influence on us as consumers. We're going to discuss these issues with Pat Michaels. He's the director of Center for the Study of Science at Cato University. Pat, welcome to Of Consuming Interest.
How are you?
Well, I'm great. And you know, I'm delighted to have you here. This is a very interesting thing because I look at everything from a consumer standpoint because that's what I do. I work in consumer issues, consumer problems, and so on. And the more I read, the more appalled I become at some of the things that have happened that are going to happen that are going to really create a big burden for consumers in terms of limiting us for choice of a lot of things and in costing us a whole lot more money. But first, let's just go back a few years. There was a big scandal, I guess you could call it a to-do that happened about, 3 years ago when it was revealed through hacking that the Climate Research Institute, is that the name of the group?
The Climate Research Unit the University of East Anglia. It's not clear whether their mails were truly hacked, whether it was an inside job by somebody who had just seen enough. Nobody has ever figured out who did this.
Go back and tell us what it was. What happened?
Thousands of emails that were on the Climate Research Unit server were made public. And these emails revealed what many of us had been saying was going on but weren't very believed, namely that there were was a small group of climate scientists who were trying to manipulate the journal publication process. They were threatening journal editors, not just with losing their journal editorships, but losing their university positions if they merely published a paper that said the world wasn't going to come to an end. One of those papers was mine. It was in 2002 paper in the journal Climate Research. And they went after the editor, Chris DeFreitas, from University of Auckland. Auckland University is the Harvard of the Australasian region. Not just as editor, but they went to the university president and said, you've got to get rid of this guy. Well, he just happened to be the associate provost for research at Auckland University. It turns out, oddly enough, that paper turned out to be correct.
Isn't that interesting?
The paper argued that it was not going to warm up as much as our computer models said it was going to. It will warm in the 21st century, it said, but about half as much as those computer models are saying. And just today, in the journal Nature Climate Change, an article appeared by Fife et al. Saying that the warming or the lack of warming that's been observed in the last 15 years has pretty much made it appear that the climate models are simply wrong.
Wow.
So, it was nice to be first.
Yeah. that's wow. And then, of course, the revelation of all of these emails just simply confirmed what a lot of people had been thinking, that the figures were being juggled.
Well, the numbers were not necessarily being juggled. It was that there was selective inclusion of certain things.
Okay, if it didn't say it go my way, I'm not going to include it.
Hey, I'd like to just blame climate scientists for this. But there was an article in Nature magazine about 5 years ago where 3,000 scientists were interviewed and asked a series of very embarrassing questions, one of which was, have you ever thrown out data that didn't fit what you thought was supposed to happen? And 16% answered yes. Now, this is basically asking if you're committing a scientific crime.
Absolutely.
What percent do you think really do this?
Yeah, the ones that admitted it are probably a small portion.
Correct.
Oh, well, we...
They're human beings. I mean, that's the whole point.
What is it that figures don't lie, but liars figure or something?
Well, I tell you what. Now that we've thoroughly discredited the issue and my particular branch of science. Why don't we talk about what matters to consumers?
Exactly. I'm totally in agreement. And we do have some things coming up that are going to make significant changes to the way we do things. The CAFE standards, for example, they're going to be phased in over a number of years, I gather. Tell us about that. And tell us what CAFE standards
consumer, are. Corporate average fuel economy.
Okay.
And it applies to the different automobile and light truck producers. The EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, is working now with a CAFE standard over 50 miles per gallon in 2026. Now, that's corporate average fuel economy. Now, people are still going to want trucks, pickup trucks.
Right.
Some people are going to want vans. They have big families. So the passenger car itself, many of the passenger cars are going to have to go way over 50 miles to the gallon for the corporation to be able to achieve this. It's very, very expensive. Check out the price of a Tesla electric car at about $100,000. I keep on hearing they're going to get cheaper, but I haven't quite seen it.
And I rode in a Tesla recently.
It's a
lovely
great car.
Vehicle, but they're, what, $100,000 or thereabouts?
It was, oddly enough, the base price is $69,000, but it seems like you pretty much can't get one out the door for less than $100,000.
Well, you're going to have all the pretty bells and whistles on it. So, but it is a lovely car.
Yeah, I just wish that it wasn't the company was not claiming a profit, not based upon selling cars, but by selling indulgences in California. The California law says each car maker has to produce X number of electric cars, and companies like Honda are pretty much staying away from this. So they have to buy a permit to not produce an electric car from somebody who produces an electric car. That would be Tesla. And I believe it was $58 million 2 quarters ago of these indulgences that allowed Tesla to claim a corporate profit.
Wow. But yet their stock is shot up.
Their stock is unbelievably high. I mean, it looks like an internet bubble stock. Or some people say, well, it's just like Apple. It's just going to
take
be
off.
Highly valued.
Yeah.
I don't own any. I don't have anything to say on it, but it really is priced very, very high.
Yeah, right. Well, it is a lovely vehicle, but here, as you said, a lot of things make it possible, and a lot of it, which is costing consumers.
Costs you and I pay for every Tesla that goes down the road.
So I have to go out and tell my friend that, hey, give me some money back on this, right? Or give me a lot of rides.
You and I pay for every Chevrolet Volt that goes down the road, not just with our partial ownership of General Motors as the people of the United States, but with the $7,500 tax reduction, income tax liability reduction, mm-hmm. that everyone who buys one gets.
Mm-hmm.
And GM has dropped the price another $5,000 to basically push these things out the showroom. These cars are so heavily subsidized. And remember, subsidies are paid by you and me. In some states, you can actually get a Nissan Leaf, that's their electric car, and make money on the transaction.
That is unreal, and we're paying for it. I don't like that. Let's just take a brief.
It still won't sell.
That's
odd. Free money, guys.
Yeah, there you go. Well, let's just let our listeners know they're tuned into Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Pat Michaels. He's director of the Center for the Study of Science at the Cato University, and we're talking about a variety of things. Pat, do you have some articles that people who want to pursue the subject of climate change costs and et cetera? Cato is a wonderful place to go. Just cato.org,
Cato.org. Yeah, it's actually Cato Institute. Cato University is something that Cato Institute puts on.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I didn't
mean to see Cato University.
Which is kind
University.
Of a series
Institute.
Of seminars on political economy. But if you go to www.cato.org and go to the experts, you can look at me, that's Pat Michaels, or my person who works with me, Chip Paul Knappenberger, Knappenberger. I'm pleased to announce we've just added to the Center for the Study of Science Richard Lindzen from MIT as a distinguished senior fellow. That's quite a
awesome.
Catch.
Yes, it is.
And we are adding Ed Calabrese who does work that's very important, potentially very important to consumers, from the University of Massachusetts. His work is on the errors in the regulatory schemes for carcinogens and other types of environmental pollutants. It's really remarkable work.
Oh, we'll look forward to hearing more about that. Let's talk about, back to the subject of the cost for consumers. Now, there are some initiatives that are going to be taking place in addition to the CAFE standards, the car fuel right. economy standards. And those are going to have significant impacts on us when we have to see our gasoline consumption going down, in effect. What about the move to get away from all fossil fuels? Where are we in this? What are the initiatives that are coming up? How is it going to impact us?
Well, we're not going to get away from fossil fuels for the foreseeable future because we don't have any substitutes. And anybody who tells you that we have viable substitutes to go to zero emissions of carbon dioxide in the United States just simply does not know what they're talking about. Mm-hmm. So they're going to be around. The real question to consumers is, first of all, it will be very expensive to switch technologies. Solar energy and wind power cannot last on their own. They have to be subsidized, again, by you and me. The Chevrolet Volt and all kinds of electric cars are losing money hand over fist for their manufacturers, so they're subsidized too. So this is a very expensive proposition that you're talking about. And I would like consumers to ask themselves, well, what do I get for all this?
Right.
I mean, if I'm going to have to pay more for my car, more for my electricity, more for everything that runs on electricity or was built by electrical energy, what am I going to get? And the answer is, you can run the EPA's own computer model and ask it, if the U.S. reduces its emissions to zero, Z-E-R-O, how much global warming will that stop? According
to
EPA's own model, you can't detect it.
Right.
It's too small to detect, even at the 2100 timescale. Interesting thing is, that's why I would argue that nothing super drastic is really ever going to happen. Because people will not impoverish themselves today for something that maybe 100 years down the road. Fortunately, it doesn't look like it's going to be as warm as people said it was going to be. And something that is going to cost them money over time. It's just not politically viable.
What's moving this? What's motivating? Why are people pushing these kinds of initiatives? From what I've read, the emissions from the rest of the world, as you just said, we can't do anything to make any kind of an impact on it.
You know,
is this so that we can go to the international bodies and say, look what we've done, why don't you clean up your act? What's the incentive for this? I don't understand it.
The odd part about this is, of course, I work with Cato, and I was at University of Virginia for 30 years, blah, blah, blah. The odd part about all of this is, again, what do you get for it? And
right.
The answer is you don't get anything for it.
But what do you pay for it?
You pay for a lot. Now, here's the cool part, though. As a Cato, I have generally argued that, well, the best thing to do about global warming is probably nothing. Because nothing is actually doing something. You see, if you do not take money away from people, they're not going to put it in a sock. They're not going to put it underneath their bed. They're going to invest it in something or somewhere.
Sure.
In some product. And the fact of the matter is that there are competitive pressures for corporations to produce things efficiently or
right.
to produce efficient things compared to their competitors. And as a result, without government assistance, with a somewhat free market, U.S. emissions of carbon dioxide have dropped to 1992 levels. Why? How? Well, there's an economic portion of that. We aren't growing as much as we were. But more importantly, the switch over from coal to natural gas for electrical generation, which occurred not because the government made it happen, but because hydraulic fracturing technology matured and spread throughout the United States. And in fact, the price of gas per unit electricity right now is running a little bit lower than coal and has been running lower than coal for years. Mm-hmm. That reduces our emissions because natural gas produces only about half as much carbon dioxide as coal does when it's used for electrical generation. So wait a minute. You don't need regulation. What you need is good old greed driving efficiencies in a market, and people are going to find a way to make the better energy mousetrap. That mousetrap does not look like a solar panel, and it does not look like a windmill. I can't tell you what it looks like, but I do know what it doesn't look like.
I've driven through the windmill fields in California. It's a very strange-looking sight, very strange. I don't really know how much of it how much they're generating. I understand they're self-sufficient, but that doesn't – are we going to cover the whole country with windmills to generate power? It's a very strange
thing. It's ugly.
They are ugly.
You know, people have chosen for economic reasons and for aesthetic reasons to produce power at increasingly dense locations. In other words, you go from – you know, campfires to fireplaces to coal-fired to coal-produced electricity to natural gas to nuclear power. You can see energy becoming denser. And this whole notion of solar and wind and all these so-called alternative technologies is against the tide of history.
Right.
It's saying reverse that. We're going to distribute our energy. We don't know how to do that.
Right.
We're just not built that way. You want to spend more money chasing that unicorn, go right ahead, but that's one expensive unicorn.
I don't want to pay for it.
Yeah. unicorns don't exist.
And there's that, too. Let's take a brief pause here to just let you know you're listening to Of Consuming Interest. I'm Shirley Rooker. My guest is Pat Michaels. He is the director of the Center for the Study of Science at Cato Institute. And you can find information at cato.org. All the studies, the things that we're talking about, the climate change discussions. And, you know, what's so interesting to me is I have friends who would sit down and tell me that we're seeing the polar ice caps receding and that we're going to have flooding on the East Coast.
Well, one out of two is not bad. Meaning,
what do you
mean?
You
have a recession in the summer ice in the North Polar region in the Northern Hemisphere.
Right.
This year is not particularly bad, by the way. It's not going to go nearly as low as it did last year or the year before that or whatever. Howsoever, the Earth has two poles.
That's right.
And around the southern pole in the southern hemisphere, the ice is expanded to the largest extent it has ever been measured at by satellites. The satellites begin in late 1978. So one is going up, the other one's going down, and as we speak today, there's a wonderful site called Cryosphere Today. That's not cry as in boohoo, but Cryosphere Today.
Uh-huh.
And you can look at polar ice as measured by satellites every day, and you will see that around now we are pretty close to completely neutral. Meaning the ice level is the same as the average for 1979 to 2000.
It's amazing.
Yeah. That's because
amazing.
The south is going up and the north is going down.
But why are we doing this? Why are we changing something that doesn't need fixing?
Well, first of all, you can't fix it, even if it needed fixing. That's the problem.
Right.
You have to live with it, and that's what we are doing. We are living with it. We are adapting to it. Just think about sea level rise on the U.S. East Coast. Sea level's going up. Oh, I don't know, some places on the East Coast pushing 18 inches. Now, global sea level from global warming rise is around half or maybe even less than half of that. The other half is because the land's sinking in the U.S. East Coast. Now, if I didn't tell you that, you would have said, I didn't know that. I didn't notice that. Because you slowly adapt
to
environmental changes. The planet's surface temperature is about 8/10 of a degree Celsius average warmer than it was in the year 1900.
Mm-hmm.
Now, and I would like to be say I'm the first person that said this, but I may be, I may not be. But it's generally a lot of people in the know argue that, you know, unless you were told that it was warmer now and told incessantly, you would not have noticed it.
No.
You simply wouldn't have noticed
agree.
It. And look at the effect it's had. corn yields 5 times as much as it did in the year 1900.
That's not a bad thing.
No. Wheat yields increased 3 times.
Not given the fact that ethanol has driven up the need for corn so tremendously.
Yeah, don't get me started on ethanol. Ethanol produces, there's another cost to consumers.
Oh, yes.
Driving up the price of corn.
We'll talk about that sometime.
No, it's amazing. And more importantly, since 1900, is more important for me and you, is that life expectancy has doubled.
Yeah, yeah.
In the industrialized world. Now, let's just talk about the world, the United States. If you double the life expectancy of, say, 200 million Americans, isn't that the equivalent of saving 100 million lives?
It's a good way of thinking about it. That's a very positive approach. I like
that. It's real.
Yeah.
If you're going to live twice as long as you were, that's like there being an equivalent of 2 U's beginning in 1900.
I like that idea.
Yeah.
Right. It's amazing. You know, you put things in such a different perspective than a lot of things that you read. You're just weird. What can I say?
Yeah.
But nice weird.
I don't
like
play
your
well
weird.
With others.
That's okay. Well, obviously you play well because you're a noted scientist. What is your background?
I have a bachelor's in biological science from University of Chicago, master's in sort of plant ecology, and a PhD in ecological climatology. That's combined what climate does and what it does to the world. From University of Wisconsin at Madison. And we started this discussion with the ClimateGate emails. There's a famous ClimateGate email where somebody who just doesn't like my sense of humor wrote to all his scientist colleagues and said, "We need to get the University of Wisconsin to reconsider Michael's doctoral dissertation because there's a fundamental error in it." And he described the fundamental error, and I actually did everything he said I should do and nothing that he said that I did. I love that to happen. His name's Tom Wigley. I wrote to his boss and said, "You guys better get a retraction out of this guy." Of course, they didn't do anything because the government, don't take this personally, people out there in radio land, sometimes the government's a bit arrogant.
You're kidding me.
Yeah, well.
Well, all right. Well, we've created it, so what can I say? But at any rate,
it's the best money can buy.
That's exactly right. So things that we have looked, what about coal? Is coal going to go by the wayside? Is coal going to still be an essential fuel?
Oh, gosh. There's a very interesting backstory on coal that I just love, which is, you know, you've heard, oh, you know about carbon taxes, right?
Yes. Yeah, I've read about them. They're confusing, but I've read.
There are proposals abounding in Washington, D.C. for a carbon tax. That's a tax on basically everything, because pretty much everything is made in part with carbon dioxide emitting energy sources. And what the coal would put coal pretty much out of business. But what the coal folks are going for, and they're pretty effective lobbyists, is if this thing were to come to pass, and I don't think it will, but if it were, it would not be taxed when it's burned. It would be taxed not when it's mined, which is what would normally occur, but rather when it's burned. And so that means you can mine all the coal that you want.
Just don't use it.
Just export it. And who's behind this? Well, I would guess Peabody Energy might be in the mix because they're the largest exporter of coal in the United States. So the old Washington game, we're going to try and buy our favors and, you know, the rest of you consumers, well, sorry about that.
Too bad. We'll make our money. As you said before we went on the air, some people don't want to sit in coach. So
we have to wonder about the longevity of the end of the world from global warming, or ends of the world for that matter.
Right.
You and I, by my calculation, have lived through 9 ends of the world.
Wow.
Did you know that?
No, I didn't.
Population bomb, acid rain, ozone hole,
low-level
ozone,
right.
World food crisis, we're going to run out of air. Can I name them all? They just go on and on.
We don't have cooling. We actually don't
global
have time.
Warming.
That's the last one.
Last one will be ocean acidification coming next.
Oh, God. Well, thank you, Pat Michaels, for being with us. He's the director of the Center for the Study of Science at Cato Institute. I am Shirley Rooker, and thank you for listening to Of Consuming Interest right here on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
of Consuming Interest is a public service program presented by WUSA 9 Call for Action, hosted by Shirley Rooker. Call for Action is an international nonprofit network of hotlines which offer free and confidential assistance. If you have a complaint, contact Call for Action at 301-652-HELP. That's 301-652-HELP.